In the second hour here, we will be doing something that, well, we do every month on the program. We have done a little changing around of the schedule so that we could get in our guest here this morning, Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is always here on a Monday, usually on the fourth Monday, and in fact, next Monday would be her regular time to be here. But we decided we're going to be doing archives on the show next week, and we wanted to have her here, didn't want to go an entire month without her. So we changed the schedule around a little bit. So we hope that indeed there will be people out there ready to ask their questions about women's health, because that's what we do each month on the show when she is here. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School and for a long time has been here on a regular basis to answer your questions. So if you'd like to talk with her, all you have to do is dial the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455. At any point here you have questions, you can call. Well, thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you. Good morning.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, I thought maybe briefly we could talk on the FDA drug approval process, since it seemed like there's so much in the news regarding some of the arthritis medications that are either being pulled off the market or some of the cousin medicines are being left on the market, and why this is and so forth. And just briefly watching some of the news, I heard individuals expressing concern about how the FDA goes about looking at medications and approving medications. Mm-hmm. And I am very much involved in the process, so I thought I would summarize briefly for listeners that process. And I think that every system that we have in the United States could always be improved slightly, but I think I can also fairly say that the approval process is very rigorous and designed to specifically find out exactly whether a drug is going to be safe, and if it's not going to be safe, does it have a sufficient risk-benefit ratio? In other words, is it safe enough, and does it do something good enough for the patients that need it to allow the approval process to go forward? And in some of these medicines that the drugs Vioxx and Celebrex that have been associated with increased heart risk are really being used at fairly high doses in a very select group of patients for purposes not what the drug was originally designed to do, and that just because that use is inappropriate, maybe there are still some appropriate uses for a drug like Celebrex, which has not been taken off the market. And to summarize the approval process, there's first, of course, the animal testing, and then there's what's called phase one testing. And phase one testing usually is safety testing. Can humans take the medication safely? And those studies are usually relatively small and small groups of fairly healthy patients. Phase two studies are usually more designed to test the hypothesis that the drug is or the medication is going to work for what you think it's going to work for. So, for instance, in my field, contraception, if we're doing a phase two study, we want to be sure that the patient is not ovulating. And we use ovulation in the field of contraception as our marker that, in fact, if we shut down ovulation, the patient's not going to get pregnant. There's probably other pathways that those medicines work, but that's the primary way. So that's usually a phase two study, and they're usually somewhat larger, a little bit more broad, but they're very much powered and designed statistically to show whether the medicine works or not. And medicines that pass phase two approval process then do go on to phase three studies. And phase three studies are usually studies with large groups of patients. I've been in phase three studies that have a few hundred patients. I've been in phase three studies that have a few thousand. I've seen phase three studies that literally, if you combine all the groups, there's over 50,000 patients tested. So they're very large, and they usually are designed, of course, to continue to test safety, and specifically as we broaden the type of patient that we allow into the studies. But as we've talked before, study research is not exactly like real life. And the patients that we take into studies want to participate, understand very well the risks and benefits of participation. They're usually only kept in the study if they follow instructions. So, for instance, if we're studying a contraceptive pill, if the patient's irregular about taking it, they're not allowed to continue in the study. They're dropped. And so we know that's not exactly like real life. Once a medicine's actually approved, occasionally there'll be what we call phase four studies. And phase four studies are using approved medicine and studying something about them. For instance, there was a very long-term study of bone density on Depo-Provera users, the injectable contraception, and that was a 7-year study. And some of that information has been released and can be now found in the package insert, and we're working on getting a publication on that research. But that was phase four study, and they looked at long-term use of Depo-Provera and whether or not it had consequences on bone density. And phase four studies are fairly commonly done, and that's approximately what was happening with the Celebrex and Vioxx study. They were using already approved medicines, but for a different reason. They were looking at these medications to see if they could prevent colon polyps, and they were powered to study that, but they also, of course, are looking at safety, and they found concerns regarding heart attacks and death rates, and those were not the primary endpoints of the study. So it takes statisticians and committees of physicians to really understand the complete implication of that one study for other patients that may be using the medicine for shorter periods of time or in different doses or different ages or different medical histories.
Mm. I guess I still find myself wondering, you know, with having gone through the testing process with as many people who have taken the medication, if you then look at some of the medications now that people take for whether it's arthritis or whether it's high cholesterol or whether it's acid reflux or something like this, we have a lot of people taking these medications. And I guess I really wonder whether you really know until you have maybe hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, taking them, and taking them over a period of, you know, who knows, 3, 5, 10 years.
Correct.
You really don't know what kind of problems you might have until you have very large patient populations taking drugs over a long period of time. And, you know, you can do all these testing and then get to the point where you say, we believe that this drug is safe and it's effective. But I guess my question, right, in my mind remains, well, do you really know until you actually have a lot more people taking it?
Well, and that's probably true. With estrogen, progesterone, those medications were on the market for 50 years. And now these new studies shed some question marks about their safety. And in the case of estrogen, we did do studies looking at large groups of patients taking the medicine over long periods of time and compare those patients to large groups of patients over years who did not take the medicine, but that was epidemiologic work, and much of it was retrospective work, so that you run into what they call the selection bias. So if you don't carefully and randomly assign who gets into which group, just the fact that maybe healthier people got into the estrogen group than the placebo group, and that probably was somewhat true, that just that selection bias going into the research study can affect what we find out. So it's been kind of frustrating. And I get a lot of questions from my menopausal patients about what estrogen either really does or does not do. So I thought if there wasn't any other caller, I might summarize some of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me just, for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in here, I just want to, because this is sort of, because it's not the usual time for you to be here.
Right.
Some people may be taken by surprise. And I just want, again, to mention to folks who are listening that our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She is on the program every month. We talk about women's health, and she is usually here in the 10 o'clock hour. And in fact, a week from now would be her regular appearance time. But we wanted to have her on the show, and she said, yes, she'd be happy to come in at a different time and a week early. But it's the same show. So if you have questions about women's health, any of the sorts of things we've talked about on past programs, you're certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Okay, so now I'm sure that you continue, because of the kinds of news that we've been having about hormone therapies over the last, I don't know how long it's been now, a couple
right.
of years, that you, oh, well, now we have a call. So I'll stop right there. We can save that because I'm sure
there's
that
no
people have
questions. There's no shortage of hormone discussions.
And there's no shortage. That's right.
Absolutely.
And I know that I'm sure you get lots and lots of questions from your patients. We've had those questions here on the show. So we can do some of those things. But we're getting some calls here, so we want to make sure we talk with the folks who are listening.
Sure.
And we'll do that. And first is Urbana, line one.
Well, I really lucked out this morning. I always listen to this program, and I never want to miss any of the speakers' points. So I feel very privileged to have turned on again. I am very pleased that you discussed, to some extent, the research process. I hear people criticizing pharmaceutical companies and feeling that they are not accepting their responsibilities to check out drugs before, during they're being sold. And because I have a daughter who is a diabetic and my granddaughter is a diabetic, I'm very interested in what you talked about this morning and the fact that there is a plan in place and that there are, as you said, some very strict, that may not have been your adjective, but some very readily identifiable directions or restrictions about what can be sold. So I think that the information that you've given is very, very important, and I think it helps to put pharmaceutical research into some perspective, matter what one's conclusions are. At least you have helped us to understand that it's not just some flippant thing that's done and then these drugs get out in the market. So I thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you. And if you want to know more, actually the FDA website has a lot of information.
Oh.
And also I have a site, so it's a little bit promotional, I guess, but there's a site called CenterWatch, CenterWatch.com. I think it's .com.
Uh-huh.
Get a little mixed up if it's .org.com.
Sure.
I think it is, though. And
CenterWatch.com.
It's CenterWatch. You'd probably get to it, and mm-hmm. It's a whole website where physicians go that are interested in participating in studies. Patients can go who are interested in participating in studies. Pharmaceutical companies go. There are actually organizations that help run these companies called contract research organization.
Oh.
And they often have information. And actually, they have a lot of good information about what it would mean to be a clinical trial participant and so forth and so on. And I think they have a lot of good information on what kinds of things are in the pipeline,
okay.
And it's pretty interesting.
And you said you have a website?
I do within the CenterWatch site. I think you can stick my name in and come up with a site. And
oh, I see.
Hopefully it's current, but okay. We try to keep it current.
Well, I really appreciate your giving that information because sometimes we do want to know more and we don't quite know how to access that. And so that's very helpful.
And
thank
it is a .com.
Okay, good.
For anybody keeping score
at home. I know
score
occasionally I've...
Okay. So we would access your info under...
You could get to my website, and it's kind of interesting. Sometimes patients write me from like California or New York and say, oh, I like the sound of this study. But, of course, when we recruit patients, they have to be a little bit closer.
Absolutely. But, well, thank you. Thank you for being there.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We will go on here. Let's see. The next caller should be in Indiana. That's line four. Hello.
Yes, I've got a three-part question. One is, with birth control, when you just start on it, how long do you have to wait before you're sure that it's really effective? Second part of that question is, does the effectiveness of it really decrease if you don't take it at the exact same time every day? And then the third, does the potency or the effectiveness of birth control long-term diminish as with other medicines?
Okay. Basically, with birth control, if you read your package insert, it'll probably tell you to use it for one full month and mm-hmm. with backup. But if you actually start extremely early in your cycle, so the Sunday either right as you're getting your period or the Sunday right after, once you've taken seven full days, statistically, you're just as likely to have ovulation suppressed as someone who had been on it a long time.
Okay.
We don't have any studies that say that contraceptive effectiveness is changed over long periods of use, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. There are people who do use the pills from teenage years to their early 50s, and they're so effective at preventing pregnancy that power actually does not diminish. And in fact, in terms of non-contraceptive benefits like prevention of cysts, prevention of ovarian and endometrial cancer builds up over time. So you get additional benefit the longer you stay on your pills. In terms of now missing pills or timing of pills,
yeah.
Now pill dosages are lower than they used to be. We say since the original advent of pills that about 98% of the hormone was removed from pills. And so that missed pill doses can translate into escape ovulations. And missed pill doses very early in the cycle probably are more likely to translate into escape ovulation. And the timing exactly, if you're somebody that by missing your pill time gets a lot of spotting, then we suspect you're somebody that is got a more borderline or a lower blood level, and that radical time differences say where you added maybe 12 or 14 hours past mm-hmm. your dosage might translate into an escape ovulation, but not usually. Usually,
try to do that's it within the same time frame.
Yeah, that just it helps, and that's why these rings that you can wear for 3 weeks or the patch that you can wear for a week and change at the end of the week is so helpful because you don't have to be to the minute with those products.
Right. Okay, well, wonderful. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you for the call. Next caller here is Aurora, line number two. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning again.
Yes.
Hello.
This is an odd question, and I wish you would help me with it because I feel it's very, very uncomfortable asking it. In fact, I wish the rest of the people could turn off their radios while
I'm here. You gotta shoot those in on email, but yes.
I have a situation where there is a very young girl, 12 in the family, has just been introduced to the family the last year and a half. And she asked my daughter when she could be on the pill. And, of course, my daughter was just shocked. And why don't I ask this question in part? What are the dangers, and what age should a girl go on the pill?
Well, if someone is having regular menstrual periods, they probably are safe to start on the pill. They've looked at whether or not the pill can, I don't want to use the wrong terminology, change development or arrest development or change the incidence. And probably if somebody had not ever had their first period, that is certainly not a candidate for the birth control pill. Of course, that's not somebody, regardless, if they've really truly never had menses, they probably are not ovulating and they're probably not at risk for pregnancy, regardless of what their calendar age is. But once someone is having regular menstrual periods, the oral contraceptive pill can indeed be safe, and it's actually a potentially good form of regulating the menstrual cycle. So young women who have not established regular menstrual cycles or having very heavy or very crampy bleeding are actually reasonably good candidates for the birth control pill, as we don't have a lot of other alternatives to control those conditions. And before somebody gets placed on the pill, she would probably have a discussion with a healthcare provider regarding risks and benefits in her case and what tests, if any, are needed. But just to get started on the pill, you do not need a pelvic exam nor a pap smear, and just seeing a healthcare provider is enough.
There seemed to be the family she came from. There seems to be a very difficult situation with the males, and that's why it was introduced. I don't know how else to say that. That's why the subject was introduced. And, of course, I'm just thinking what a tragic situation to have to discuss. But it's
most family physicians, most pediatricians,
yes,
and most gynecologists that deal with adolescents are very well equipped to deal with these issues, and probably making individual contact with a healthcare provider is the best strategy.
Well, thank you for so much for listening.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, thanks for the call. I hope that helps. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is a gynecologist, obstetrician. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School, and once a month she stops by on the program. It's always a Monday, usually the fourth Monday at 10, to talk about women's health. And whatever questions you have, I know she'll do her best to give you an answer, as long as it falls within her area of practice, of course. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And next is someone in Indiana. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello. Two things. One, in regards to the lady you talked about getting information on the ways a drug comes into play and how it finally accepted. I think the concern with the Vioxx and the Celebrex was that there was a suppression of negative evidence at one of the stages that had nothing to do with the actual mechanics of how we test drugs, but it was had to do more with the integrity of information that was given on to the federal people, so that they could go to the next step to make other, expand the testing itself. My second question, not just a statement. Second thing, since you sort of opened the door earlier about the website, is oftentimes on WBBM 780 up in Chicago, a commercial will come on or an ad asking if you have the following situation, contact us. You may be eligible for a study in which, and they usually tell you most of the things you're going to happen to you are free. And I just wonder if those things are legit, or since you brought up, how they you go after people for tests themselves and all this stated on that website. I just wonder if that's legitimate, or is that someplace where you end up paying a lot of money, in a sense, either for nothing or it certainly wasn't the thing you should have done in the first place. Thanks.
Well, one aspect of studies that I didn't get a chance to go into depth is that every study that involves human subjects goes through something called review by an institutional review board, an IRB. And a lot of those websites, the FDA site, NIH sites, the CenterWatch site I was talking about, will explain what IRBs are. And IRBs are usually made up of a variety of individuals. And that would include lay people, professional scientific people, physicians, may include clergy. They're usually fairly large panels who review the research. And they will review the research from a variety of standpoints and sign off that, in fact, it's okay to proceed. And when the IRB, again, this is one process, and not that mistakes can't be made or not that interpretation can't vary, but at least this basic step has happened. And in some studies, local studies are conducted. So, for instance, here, if it's a strictly a University of Illinois research study, the University of Illinois IRB would review it. If a local hospital is a site for a study, they often will have IRBs. If it's a physician working for a pharmaceutical company, they will be usually assigned a professional IRB somewhere. And these IRBs take their responsibilities very seriously. Most of them do a lot of fact checking. Most of them, some of them actually visit you. Even though they're from far away, you'll get a site visit. And any advertising, get back to your question, which was, what about these radio ads? Any advertising, first of all, has to be approved by the IRB. So, number one, that study has been IRB approved to continue, but any material that is used in advertising purposes has to be reviewed. And I can tell you, it's very unlikely you heard the word free, F-R-E-E, because it is highly discouraged that we use that word. Now, standing back, it is true. When you participate in medical research, usually direct study-related costs, if they want you to have a physical, they will pay for a physical. They will pay that physician to do that physical. So it is at no cost to you, which, you know, is a little bit of a distinction from that quote-unquote free word. If they need certain lab work done to decide whether you qualify, or they are using certain lab tests to monitor the safety of the medicine, they will draw that blood from you and send it off to the lab, and you will not get a direct charge. Now, not every single aspect of your medical care is going to be covered. And for instance, let's say you're on medicine to decrease your cholesterol, and you've had trouble with a foot fungus on and off, and your foot fungus flares up. Most likely, this is going to be deemed not study related, and it won't necessarily be covered. The study consent forms that are done, are given to patients before you can actually participate, are often 10 to 15 pages long. I personally think they've gone overboard and they're too long, but they make every possible effort to explain to you, number one, why they're doing the study. Number two, what your responsibilities are going to be. Is this a one-month study? Is this a seven-year study? Do you have to keep diaries? Do you have to make phone calls come in? How often do you have to show up for appointments? These sorts of things are explained in great detail. Very often, they'll explain tests and procedures that may have to be done. For instance, I do a lot of clinical research in the area of human papilloma virus, HPV disease. And in these kinds of studies, if you have an abnormal pap smear, you may need additional testing. So it explains all about what that additional testing might involve, even though you may go through the entire study with normal pap smears and never actually get those tests. They will also explain to you if they're going to pay you. And we're not really paying patients to participate. It may sound like that. But what we're doing is occasionally reimbursing patients for their time and effort. And it is true, longer studies that involve lots of visits and lots more effort may, in fact, pay a little bit more than other studies. But in fact, this specific issue is looked at very carefully by the IRB, specifically with respect to, could this be so much money that it's coercive? If they deem that the payment would be coercive, they don't allow you to pay the patients that much. So every aspect is scrutinized. And I think you mentioned one of the radio stations in Chicago. And I think that when you hear these study ads, if you call the number, you can find out who's conducting the study, what pharmaceutical company, if any, or maybe for a National Institute of Health study, for instance. And you can find out who the institutional review board is. And in the consents, if you do participate, not only do they lay out how you can get a hold of study related people if you have a question about your continued participation, but they specifically lay out the name and phone number of the institutional review board, and you can call them and find out what's going on. And I think that in general, I have found they do a very good job. Now, to also get back to Part A and whether there's questions about suppressed evidence, and that is an issue because negative findings are treated a little bit differently. For instance, if somebody was studying a contraception medicine that didn't prevent ovulation, the company might, for instance, choose to discontinue that research. So what happens with that research study? Does it ever get published and so forth? And traditionally, it's remained intellectual property of the companies. And now there's a big move to have open access to most of the studies and a lot more of the information. And I'm not quite up to speed on all the developments. Many of the companies that I'm working with are looking specifically at participating in programs like that. So there is more open access to information, both to patients and scientists. But I think that process could probably be improved.
Hmm. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. I guess that, you know, one of the things that, that concerns a lot of people is that the way the system is set up now for drug approval, we're relying on the manufacturer to do the testing. There's a little bit of conflict of interest there.
Well, some, definitely. Of course, then the flip side, who's going to be interested enough to do it? And there are medications that aren't completely supported by a drug company. There are some things that, that have to be supported by basic science research, government funding, and so forth, particularly for rare conditions. It's hard to find the patients if the condition's too rare, and it would be almost impossible to be able to finance the studies. And although we are relying on the companies, I think some of the systems in place help the process move on. And you just look at as many, you go to a library, pull off the shelf the PDR, and that is a compendium of all the package inserts. So that is your basic information about how many medicines we have available to us. And it's just scads and scads. I mean, just only too many to count. However, it's very surprising, just in my field alone, and I don't, of course, don't know in depth about the other fields, how many medications are available worldwide that we do not have access yet here. And we won't, even though there's one medicine we're going to be studying coming up soon for heavy menstrual bleeding. And in fact, you might hear some radio ads for that. But at any rate, this is a medicine approved in many countries. It's even over the counter in some places. And it's not something we have access to here yet in the United States. So our approval process is still whole jumps ahead of what it could be.
Well, we have about 20 minutes, a little bit less, in this hour of focus. We have some other callers. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign once a month. Usually on the fourth Monday, she is here to answer your questions on women's health. And we have her here a week early, but otherwise it's the same show. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of other callers here, one in Champaign, one in Urbana. We'll go Champaign first. Line one. Hello.
Yes, my call is very, very brief, mostly a comment. I wanted to thank Dr. Troopin, and I wanted to wish her a happy holiday, and you too, David. And thank you, and I'll hang up.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, thank you. That's very nice. We'll just go on to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Two?
Yes.
Hello.
Hey.
This has been a very interesting program this morning. This is really more of a comment than it is a question. I have a brother-in-law who's been a pharmaceutical chemist with big companies. He's been in there in the lab actually making this stuff for around 30 years. And his comments, he's told me, he said, if just don't take any more medication than you absolutely have to. You know, just, you know, be careful. But then I have a brother-in-law who was diagnosed with diabetes, and he had the theory, well, if I can take a pill and not change my lifestyle, I'll go that way. So I imagine doctors have a little bit of frustration trying to deal with patients who absolutely can't or won't make lifestyle changes that might make it possible for them to use less medication. And that was my comment.
Well, it's very true. And we now even have an official TLC, Therapeutic Lifestyle Changes. And really, practically every disease you can talk about or condition, you know, even conditions like pregnancy, but diabetes is a perfect example, heart disease, of course, any of the diseases that deal with smoking. We talk to our patients a lot about therapeutic lifestyle changes. And I think my tiny bit of insight, having struggled to make my own therapeutic lifestyle changes, good thing there's radio, and that I think that what we need to do is, you know, people talk about baby steps, and I think we need to talk to our patients about, okay, well, here's what we would really like, and here's how we're going to start, and here's how we're going to get going, and here are things that are reasonable. And I would think that the majority of patients, if you say, okay, now you're going to quit smoking and you're going to cut your calories in half and you're going to do an hour of exercise a day and you're never going to take another drink of alcohol, you know, or yeah, I'm just trying to give an example where if you pile too many assignments on at once, really probably I think most people would just say, give me the pill, I'm swallowing it, and I'm leaving the office now. But if
right.
you can try, and there we are trying to get some of this education process started early and try to prevent the weight gain to begin with so that you don't have so much to lose. And some of those more realistic things try to encourage people that actually, if you're not going to start a formal exercise program, taking the stairs at work is exercise. Just avoid that elevator and so forth and so on. Little things. You know, try to get up and change the channel now and then. Get your own glass of water. And so I think that there are ways, and there's lots of basic science research on how you best handle making those TLCs. But you're absolutely right. So much of what we actually treat with pills could be treated better with the lifestyle factors.
Well, I do believe, though, that I'm seeing and hearing a whole lot more than I did even 5-10 years ago about, you know, things people can do on their own or with a little bit of help to make lifestyle changes that will help them have to use a lot less medication.
Correct. Mm.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
We have, again, about 15 minutes left. I think we're getting another caller here ready to go. If you have questions for our guest.
Well, one further comment I was going to make is that as we live longer, even if you have lived quite healthy, we do develop conditions. And the current statistics, for instance, show that 85% of women will develop hypertension before they die. So, you know, that's a very high number of patients that will ultimately be taking some sort of therapeutic intervention for high blood pressure. And if we can delay it even 1 or 2 years, that's a huge impact on society and individually. And yet we do have to realize that at some point we may come down to taking those pills.
Well, I appreciated the list of things that the lifestyle changes that you made, and anybody can make that list. You know, we've all heard enough about what's good for us, what we should be doing, and what not. if you could, and you said, and I think very rightly, if you sat down with somebody and said, okay, you got to do all these things, you got to start tomorrow, they're going to say, what, are you kidding me, Doc?
Yeah.
Okay, suppose you pick one. I mean, it would be possible to say,
right,
okay, if you had to pick one, what one thing would have the maximum benefit in terms of public health?
Physical activity. The more active you are, the healthier you are. In every way, you think better, you sleep better, better sex, you lose weight, physical activity.
Okay, there you go, ladies and gentlemen.
And the more active you are, the better off you are, to some extent.
Yeah.
You know.
All right. Very good. Let's talk we'll go to line 4, and that caller is in Terre Haute. Hello.
Yes. I take statins, or used to. I took Lipitor, and I couldn't stand it, and then the doctor put me on 20 milligrams of Zocor. And I took it for a while, and then I ached and whatever, and I quit. And then I farm, and then during the summer I didn't take it. And this fall, you know, you tell you it's getting sluggish again, so I took it again, and I felt okay, but then it started to ache again, and I quit. My question is, why on the pamphlet that comes with the Zocor, they say to start it up as soon as you can to prevent liver damage. How do you derive liver damage from not taking this drug off and on?
I think the question might be too technical for me. It would depend on some of your other health factors, what else is going on.
I don't have
with the liver, any other medicines.
There's no other medicine.
Many medicines are processed by our liver, and when you take a medicine, you have your enzyme system sort of cranked up, and those factors don't necessarily turn off as fast as the medication, and that might in fact impact. But beyond that, I think maybe time to make a consult appointment with the physician giving you those medicines and talk about alternatives and strategies that are really best for you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's probably about as good as we can do here and within this program. Obviously, if you have questions, you know people should either take them up with their doctors. They can always take them up with their pharmacist. I think that pharmacists are probably an underused resource for people when they have questions about their medicines. They don't know that that is one possibility, that people can indeed go and ask the pharmacist at the place where they got their medications if they have questions. That would certainly be possible. I wonder sometimes too, you know, maybe people are taking some kind of medication and then they experience something. And they think, well, this must be because of the medicine that I'm taking. And it might be, but then again, you know, it might not have anything to do.
That is an excellent point. And before starting or stopping medicine on your own or tapering dosage, making that contact with a prescribing office is important.
Yeah, because I would think it would be really problematic if you start to take something for a while and then you stop, and then you start again and you stop, you're certainly not going to. If there is a benefit to be gained, you're not going to get it if you're taking it that way.
It can be very costly. Yeah.
And I know, I'm sure that for a lot of doctors, it's really a tough simply getting people to take the medicines the way they're supposed to.
That's
is
true.
Tough.
Compliance is tough.
It's tough. All right. Well, let's try. Let's go on. Pontiac, I think, is next. Line 1. Hello.
Hello. I have a question. My wife and I are both vegetarians, and something that we've been told to look out for is make sure that we don't get an anemic or anemia. We've both been talking to our doctors about it, but we take a really decent multivitamin, that has like 138% iron in it. But my wife still seems to sort of have, like, I guess, like the initial effects of anemia, a lot of tiredness and sluggishness. And we've kind of isolated other things. And I know that a lot of things in your diet can affect how readily you absorb iron. And so we're kind of wondering if, you know, should we look at like a low dosage, an extra supplement for iron? Because we try getting things in our diet, but since we don't eat red meat, you know, it's really difficult to find other things that are high enough in iron that we could eat on a daily basis.
Well, it's an excellent question. And usually in situations like this, I advise you to see a healthcare provider and get some blood tests, because anemia can very easily be detected on a blood test. And there's a test called ferritin that checks your iron stores. You can also get serum levels of folate or B12 or iron if it's appropriate in your case. And I hate to tell people what blood tests to get over the radio. I mean, really, you should work with your own physician.
Right.
But getting those tests done confirm whether you have an iron deficiency or not. It's actually not really recommended to get your blood iron sky high either. And if in actuality you're not anemic and you're attributing these symptoms of anemia to anemia, then you gotta look elsewhere. But if you are, then it's fairly easy to use blood tests to guide changes in your supplements or your diet.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. And next is Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Question about nursing and infections. They call it mastitis.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
well, I'm starting
feeding a baby and getting a breast infection.
Well, I'm weaning, starting to wean.
Yes.
And so I haven't had any problems so far, but I've all of a sudden started to see some like red, dark red kind of splotches on my breasts, and some of them are actually itchy, so I don't know if it's a rash so much or if it's kind of related to what they call the an infection, because someone said it would be red, some kind of red splotches sometimes if you have an infection.
Well, it can be. This would be something fairly tricky to diagnose over the phone. But
no, that's, I'm just saying, are there some regular symptoms I should be aware of and then maybe have to go in and see?
Well, definitely if you're running a fever, that would be something that you would be needing to check out. Definitely if the breast is tender to touch or if you develop an area of firmness that is tender to touch. Those are definite warning signs that need to be treated.
What do you mean by area of firmness? I mean, because I'm nursing, and so, you know, there's hardness sometimes when I'm, you know, the milk is there and stuff. I guess
that doesn't resolve after you feed.
Oh, that's still there. Okay.
And if it's a minor skin condition, you might consider calling your healthcare provider, describing this, what you see on the skin, and maybe it could be something simple like yeast or something that they can tell you how to treat topically. Otherwise, you pretty much have to get seen.
Okay.
If you're developing splotchiness.
Really? Okay. So that's just the usual way to go. Okay. Because I don't have a fever. That's why I didn't think it was so much an infection, but then I heard that, well, if it's red, then there could be some problems.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
So even if I don't have a fever, that could still be the case?
It could be. Most likely, if you're having no discomfort, no areas of tenderness, and no fever, if it is an infection, it's very, very early in the time sequence.
Otherwise, like you said, it could be like a yeast thing instead, which wouldn't...
Well, it could be something topical from the way it sounds.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we're coming down here to the point here. We have maybe about 2 minutes left. Probably
well,
not enough time to do...
Well, and I was going to tell that caller, I think that both Provena Hospital and Carle Hospital have good lactation consultants, and you can always call the hospitals and ask to get routed to the lactation consultants, and they can often give advice as well.
Okay. Is the breast infection, is that a common problem for a woman who breastfeeds?
I wouldn't say the word common, but not uncommon is probably how I would term it. We do see it, but typically if women are fully emptying their breasts, they usually do very well without infections. And sometimes I see breast infections years after they've discontinued breastfeeding. So it can happen in non-lactating females as well. Well, I was just very quickly going to talk about seasonal affective disorder.
Oh, sure.
I'll give it the 1 minute treatment.
Okay.
But they say that if you're in an indoor room, the light is under 100 lux, L-U-X, but don't ask me for the physics definition of that. And if you're outside in the sun, it's about 10,000. And if you get seasonal affective disorder, we think that it can respond to light therapy. And we usually say that you needed to have gotten the symptoms of seasonal affective disorder over about a 2-year period of time, and the symptoms are increased wanting to sleep, increased appetites, especially for carbohydrates, and people do gain weight when they have this condition. And we're still recommending light boxes as a good, safe treatment for it. But like with other conditions, psychological conditions, it's probably worth seeing your healthcare provider and getting an accurate diagnosis before you try that on your own. And light boxes are about 2,500 lux. So there's my 1 minute summary.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Dr. Suzanne Troopin, she is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School. And once a month, she is here on the program, and we talk about women's health.